If you've been watching the Winter Olympics, you may have noticed the increasing role that tech is playing, not just for the athletes, but for us, the viewers. Using drones, AI, and cloud-based broadcasting, we can track curling stones, freeze mid-air jumps, even talk to an official Winter Olympics chatbot, turning sport into something more immersive and high-tech than ever before. So, will this tech stick around? Are we witnessing the future of sports spectatorship? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter, we have Chris Berg, Professor of Economics at RMIT. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also David Browey, Technology Journalist at Information Age. Welcome back, David.
Thanks, very great to be here.
Now, it's being described as a landmark court case. There's a 20-year-old in Los Angeles taking on Meta and YouTube, claiming that they are intentionally addictive. Lawyers are saying that this case could set a precedent for holding social media companies accountable for how they design products used by young people. So, Chris, what features of Instagram and YouTube are alleged to be addictive in this case?
The particular features are things like the infinite scroll. So the fact that you can just keep scrolling down on social media platforms until, well, it doesn't stop. It just finds you more and more content. The other one is autoplay as well. Some videos, as you know, on social media will automatically play at you. You can change that in the settings, but they'll by default automatically play at you. And again, that's claimed to be something that keeps people on the platform, makes it very difficult for people to leave.
And David, what harms is the plaintiff claiming here?
The plaintiff is known as Kaylee, or they call her KGM. She's 20 now, but she says that she's been using social media for many years, particularly things like Meta and YouTube, which have led her to develop anxiety and body dysmorphia and thoughts of suicide as well. So some pretty sad outcomes, I think, from many years of using the platform. And she's basically saying that the way that these systems have been designed has almost trapped her in this sort of spiral of negative stuff, which has really affected her well-being pretty fundamentally.
So what mental health impacts are linked to social media use?
So it's very difficult to be precise about what is directly caused by social media use. There's a lot of claims that have been made, some with strong evidence, some with weaker evidence, that there is a correlation between social media use and mental health impacts, anxiety and so forth, and the body dysmorphia and those sorts of issues that have been raised in this case. But my read of the scientific literature here is that it's very difficult to find causation, in part because everyone's using them. So the question becomes, are we tracking changes in mental health across society because of social media, or just social media is increasing and there are other things going on in society too that are creating these challenges? Now, that's going to be a really big part of this case if they're going to try to prove that there's specific damage caused by these social media networks.
That's an interesting point you bring up. It would be almost impossible to find a control group of people who have been sheltered from the existence of social media to be able to either prove or disprove if something is correlation or causation, right?
I mean, you say that, except, of course, Australia now has an under 16 social media ban, so maybe the country of Australia, which is an interesting thing, right? So in Australia, we've decided to, or the government has decided to ban social media, and it seems to be treating that as a great success. But the only reason that we would want to do that is if it had long-term mental health benefits, and that's what this case will presumably need to look at.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things about this, we talk about correlation versus causation. It's always a big question. And as Chris was saying, it's not always clear exactly what causes it. But over time, you can kind of see that people are processing differently, that kids that have grown up with social media are perceiving the world and interacting with the world in different ways. One of the things that has come out in this particular lawsuit is that Kelly's lawyer is saying that the social media companies have engineered addiction in children's brains. So it's not just that it's an issue of correlation. She's alleging causation, that they specifically did this to addict these kids, the scrolling and the swiping, and they've likened it to pulling the handle of a slot machine. So there's a very important distinction, and I think that's one of the reasons that this case is being watched so closely, because they are going straight at the companies and saying, you did this intentionally to trap the kids.
And what are the companies saying in their defence? What is Meta and Google saying against these claims that they are intentionally trying to get kids addicted to social media?
So Meta and Google obviously deny that they're trying to make kids addicted, but in my mind, there's a really strong free speech defense that they have. So this is a court case that's going in the United States. The United States has the strongest free speech defense in its First Amendment to the US Bill of Rights, which protects freedom of speech and the way that speech is expressed. So not just the content of the speech, but the means by which speech is expressed. You know, you wouldn't say that the content of a newspaper is fine, but the fact that you ordered the news on the page in some particular way is illegal.
And have there been similar lawsuits that other social media companies have settled, or even Meta and Google have settled in the past, David?
I think the number at the moment is about 1,500 cases are currently pending. The one that's suing in this case, Kaylee, has also sued Snap and TikTok, but apparently those companies actually settled the case ahead of trial. Which is interesting in itself. I think each of the social media companies has their own approach to this and their own philosophical stance. And even though they all say, well, it wasn't us, in the end, some, I think, are a bit more pragmatic about it. Whereas, Meta, for example, is pushing back very hard and saying, it's not our fault, it's your fault, it's your parents' fault, it's everyone else's fault. However, this one is resolved, set a precedent for a lot of those other 1,500 cases that are coming down the pike.
Do we have a psychological definition at the moment for addiction to the internet? Is it something that exists medically?
Yeah, to my knowledge, you can be addicted to lots of different things, but I'm not a psychologist, so I'll defer to psychologists here. But the idea that we can be, we've grown out the concept of addiction so that it captures more and more behavior, and then we throw it out as a legal claim. And I'm very concerned that we can say that about almost anything that we're all into. You might be addicted to any hobby that you might have, and then you could bring in front of a jury trial and make a claim that the people who were helping you with that hobby are therefore liable for the negative consequences of your quote addiction. So I'm very concerned about the psychologizing of these choices that people are making and the way that they're engaging with products. It's certainly possible for people to be addicted to lots of different things, but should we treat that as a public policy problem or something that we can litigate against against companies and providers of services? I'm pretty worried about.
It is a challenge. The psychological community is actually looking at this. There's something that's been discussed called social media use disorder, or SMUD, and I think there's a lot of discussion about whether it should be included in DSM, which is, the gold standard for psychiatric disorders and psychological disorders. They see it as a sort of an offshoot and something that's very related to a lot of other behavioral addictions and some of the features of it that are pretty common in the social media world are being recognized as being very closely tied to some of the other addictive sort of issues that have been recognized. So it is, I think it is a work in progress as far as I know, but they're certainly looking at it. Yeah, it's a very complex issue that really didn't exist 20 years ago at all. So it's something we're having to deal with as a result of modern society, I guess. And we're finally now seeing the outcomes of it as a whole generation comes through.
And if this verdict goes the way of the plaintiff, if Meta and Google are ruled against in this lawsuit, what would this change about platform design features? Would this mean the end of infinite scroll or autoplay? What would meaningfully change, do you think?
These sorts of litigations are aimed for settlements or aimed for compensation and so forth. But if a jury found that there was something worth compensating for, then the companies might feel that they had to make design choices. I'm very uncomfortable doing this sort of public policy decision-making through litigation and through certainly private litigation like that. I think we should be making these choices as democracies and we should be running that through the public policy process, particularly if we're going to be incentivizing companies to change. I think that's much more reliable, and we can debate it democratically about what we want rather than running it through this sort of litigation-centric strategy.
How about you, David? What do you feel is likely to happen?
Well, it's anybody's guess, I think, at the moment. One of the issues, certainly about jurisdiction, is that this that we're talking about is all in the US and subject to US laws and US norms and all this. And social media definitely has been ruled by that. But we've seen it, I think, become a more global conversation in Australia with the social media age restrictions. For example, there was a time when the government said, listen, we get what you're saying, but also we have values too. And I think you're seeing more and more countries do that. France, I think, has come to the table recently with a similar sort of age ban. We're starting to see a lot more cracking down, I think, on the U.S. standards and simply, getting governments that are saying, listen, we understand you have your First Amendment, but that doesn't apply here and it can't be anything goes. And so I think over time you're going to see more accommodations for the vagaries of, regional laws and regional social standards and that sort of thing. And they really will have to do that because I think they've stopped just boldly getting away with anything. People are very aware of this. And so something's going to have to change a bit, whether that translates into a restriction on the infinite scroll, for example, whether that translates into who knows what other filters they could put on or restrictions. I don't know. Typically, I think what they'll try to do is just make everything opt-in to say that, we offer this if you want it, but otherwise we default to the broadest level of access as is legally possible.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Chris Berg, who is a professor of economics at RMIT, and also David Browey, who is a technology journalist at Information Age. The speculation that the US could gain access to Australian biometric and identity records, it's raising some questions around privacy, consent, how governments value information at the moment. So let's start. David, what data is the US seeking from Australians?
Yeah, well, there has been an escalation in the past few years. Everybody's been watching it in the news about the US becoming very strict about, who's coming into the country, who's in the country. They're looking at the whole spectrum of migration issues. And one of the things that they have really settled on was a requirement that people that want to come into the US are willing to provide more information about themselves. They want to know who's coming, and simply writing your name on a piece of paper and your date of birth is no longer considered to be enough. So there are new policies in place where they are moving to basically require that if you want to get into the US, you need to provide quite a range of information, which includes your social media history, some of your personal and work contact details, a lot of details about your family members as well, and also biometrics, which is a little bit of a sticky situation because anybody who's traveled to the U.S. recently knows that they're already doing this. You get into the country and they photograph you. There's thumbprints taken, fingerprints taken. So they have been collecting this information for a while, just through the new systems that are in place. And it's designed to not only make the process a lot quicker at the borders, but also to make sure that they can confirm your identity better. The new passports that are being issued have a lot of information in them that they can compare it to. So this is all part of a tighter migration strategy on the part of the U.S., and Australia is doing a similar thing as well. And what's become sticky is that they're saying that basically this is going to continue and that the U.S. can extend the scope of this. And that's where it gets a bit messy, like where they could proactively potentially request certain types of data or proactively demand certain types of data from the Australian government or from the government of other countries in advance of that interaction at the border. And so there's a whole question of how much information is Australia giving? How much information would Australia be willing to give to maintain its favorable treatment, which it has now with the US?
So is this a done deal? Has the Australian government agreed to this expanded sharing? And if they haven't yet, what can we do about it if we don't want them to do it?
It's going to be hard to run a large-scale campaign against this because it's for a very small class of travellers that goes regular to the United States and is deeply concerned about that, unless, of course, they give information about everybody. And the other thing is that, we don't really value privacy. Certainly, we don't tend to value our privacy when the government is taking information about us. It's hard to get people excited about this, as concerning as it is.
David, why is biometric information in particular so sensitive when we have these conversations?
It's a good question. We are so used to having our passwords breached and our date of birth or whatever else information. We hear about the billions of records that are out there, email addresses and things that scammers are using. The thing that's different about biometric information is that it's part of you. I mean, everybody is different in your fingerprints, your iris and your what have you. Each have a different signature, which is unique to us, and you can't change that. But the thing about it is that this biometric information can actually tell people a lot about you, your ethnicity, your race, some disabilities you might have, your health situation, even your emotional state. These can all be deduced through biometric information. So they can use this information to determine a lot more about you, perhaps, than even you realize. And that's, I think, the concern is it's a slippery slope. Once you start providing this information, what are they going to do with it? And what conclusions will they draw about who you are? And what are your motivations, for example, for going to the US? At the moment, they're doing that through trolling your social media. And there have been cases where Australians have gone to the US and had them go through the social media, and they've been told to go home, which is incredible. But that's the way it is now. And imagine if they just scanned your iris when you got there and felt that you, you were a dishonest person and you were very anxious about something or whatever. The number of things that you can tell by looking at a person is significant. And so that's why there's so much sensitivity around this type of information.
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Chris Berg, who is a professor of economics at RMIT, and also David Browey, who is a technology journalist at Information Age. And if you're tuning in to the 2026 Winter Olympics, you'll be seeing first-person drones flying alongside skiers and luges, AI creating these instant 360-degree replays. Behind the scenes, there's this cloud-based broadcasting delivering hundreds of live feeds while also apparently cutting energy use. So there's a lot going on tech-wise with the Winter Olympics. David, what new broadcast technologies are being used this year?
Well, there's quite a lot of them out there. I've been watching a lot of the skiing, for example, and they have the drones that are going there now that are following the skiers down the hill from behind. This sort of first-person visualization is really something I think we haven't seen before, and it's quite cool because you get, especially for these, a lot of these sports are very fast, you get a really good sense of what's going on. And, this is a viewpoint that's very different than watching a skier from the sidelines. If you watch these skiing and the jumps and that sort of thing with the mute on your TV, it's probably better because there is a constant whining noise through all of these events, which they haven't bothered to filter out. But beyond that, it's very cool to see. That's one of them, for example. Another one is they're getting these sort of real-time 360-degree replays, which is something you see, for example, in the figure skating, where they'll watch. They'll show someone who's skating across the rink and does a jump, and then they can pause and basically zoom around them using the sort of in 360-degree to show from different angles. And they can also, when they're analyzing a jump, they'll have about 10 different cutouts of the person at different stages of the jump to show how high they went and when they're spinning and where they made that fatal mistake that caused them to fall over, that sort of thing. It's very cool to see what they've been adding to the broadcast. And there's certainly been quite a lot of advancements, I think, that are there. They've also integrated some GPT capabilities as well.
I know. This is really interesting. Chris, could you tell me a little bit more about Olympic GPT? What is going on here? Do we need a specific chatbot for the Winter Olympics? Is this really necessary?
We probably don't. And it's good to see that they're experimenting with it. But so Olympics GPT is Olympic GPT. It's just a chatbot that is Olympic focused and will give you results and rules and those sorts of things and AI summaries and all that sort of stuff. But what I think is, and I think, yeah, that's fine. It's probably a little bit gimmicky. I don't know how many people are using it, but I think the more interesting thing here is though, that we get these Olympics every 2 years. And of course we get the big one every 4 years. What we're seeing now is that capability that is connected to all the AI development starting to be realized in particular products, like the 3D reconstructions and all the fluid camera movements and the bullet time type stuff and all that. That's all thanks to really back-end technology that has come from the same AI technology that does power things like Olympic GPT and ChatGPT and Claude and all the stuff that we use every day. And we're now starting to see sort of the downstream benefits from some of that tech and what happens when people creatively apply it to new problems. We've got AI operated drones so they can direct themselves, so we're not having to manually fly drones in different ways. So I think it's only going to get faster and more interesting from here, particularly in this sort of consumer level, entertainment level stuff. And what we're seeing here is sort of a test bed for the sorts of cross economy things that we're going to be seeing in 6 to 12 months.
I'd also love to chat about the significance of cloud-based broadcasting. A lot has been made of this and the advantages that it has. David, why is this a big deal?
Well, it's definitely a big change. I mean, in the past, live broadcasts were always done by satellite or terrestrial fiber links or whatever. They were managed very much through the gatekeepers, which are the local networks. So it might be Channel 9 here in Australia and, I don't know, CBS or NBC in America or whatever. I mean, there's always been a lot of rights attached to the Olympic Games. There were limits on how many channels they could show at a time. There's only so many TV channels and you got to decide what's important. And that's why we see, for example, Channel 9 at the moment is mainly focusing on events that include the Australians, but they're not showing a lot of other stuff. The cloud-based broadcasting is a big change to that because basically it means that it gives you the flexibility of distributing the footage any way that makes sense. And so you're seeing a lot more, I think, flexibility in the way people are accessing it, the flexibility in the way the broadcasters are accessing it. You have that sort of, I think, main database of Olympic content, and then people can take it as they want it and reuse it in different ways from a central cloud repository. For example, in Australia, Stan has the rights now, and they're showing all the events. You can go in and pick anything you want to see at any time, and that's all because of the cloud-based broadcasting, which is a much better way, I think, to experience the Olympics and to be able to see the things that you want to see. So it is a much more efficient way to move a lot of content anywhere in the world where it's needed.
Are we seeing technologies introduced for the Winter Olympics that you think will stay across all sports? Are we going to be seeing these 360-degree drone replays happening while we're watching the footy, do you think, Chris?
Look, there's a strong possibility. I worry about the drones because that must be incredibly annoying.
It'd be so distracting. They're so noisy.
There. They're so focused to doing the moguls and things, and they've got a drone 3 meters behind them. It's so loud. You wonder if they're going to jump up and like hit the drone if something goes wrong. That would be a spectacle.
I hope people are working on quieter drone technology. I'm sure they
absolutely are.
Absolutely. I hope they are. So, we're definitely going to see more and more of this stuff rolled out. What's interesting about the Olympics, of course, is it's not just one sport. It's dozens and dozens of sports. So if you're hosting the Olympics, you need to have technology that works for a huge range of sports that have totally different needs, and the entertainment value is totally different for all these different sports. But if you're running the AFL or if you're running a basketball tournament, you've got a much more defined field. So you can see interesting experiments that happened at the Winter Olympics or the Future Summer Olympics. You can say, hey, that was really cool. Let's see what we could do in this much more fixed and defined area. So I just think, as I say, I think it's just going to get more and more and faster and faster, and the entertainment value of these sports is going to go up and up.
Let's take a look at a bit of tech that actually brought us some joy this week. David, what do you have?
I was thinking about it because I have a lot of tech coming in and out of the house, being a professional nerd.
You're
always
in good
happens.
Company here.
Absolutely. So I was trying to think of what was the thing that brought me joy, which is a very specific question because some of it is just useful. I've put a camera in the front yard to see what's going on there, to see you feel like you know what's happening. One of these AI cameras. They recognize what's in the video and they can categorize it and that sort of thing. And one of the things that it captures is animals. It said, oh, there were 6 animals that crossed your property last night. I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I had a look and it turns out we have a fox.
A fox? Amazing.
Oh, I didn't know. And the fox just was wandering across the yard looking for someone's pet to eat, I guess.
And Chris, what tech has brought you joy this week?
Look, this week, I mean, I'll just talk about what brought me joy today. I feel like in the AI space, everybody, we're getting almost daily releases of new products. And today's product that I literally was playing with just before we were having this conversation is called Claude's Cowork. So Claude Cowork is now available for Windows. What this will do is it lets Claude, the AI model, Claude by Anthropic, it'll let it loose on folders that you give it or files that you present it. And it can do things like rearrange them, restructure them. It can take all your data in a folder that you point it to and, you know, make me an Excel spreadsheet out of this. What I've got it doing is looking at, I've got all these text file notes and I've got it sort of reorganizing and restructuring that and trying to find connections between the notes and the ideas that I might have for papers or books or articles, and come up with new ideas for me that I can, some of them are good, some of them are terrible, but, you know, I can look through that and say, hey, that's an interesting one. I wouldn't mind digging further into that. I'm unrelentingly excited by this sort of stuff at the moment.
I'm always excited to hear use cases. So thank you so much, Chris. And thank you for joining me on Download This Show today. Where can people find you and your work?
I'm very easy to Google, just Chris Berg at RMIT, and you'll see me there.
Perfect. And thank you, David Browey. Where can people find you and your work?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, of course, but my stories appear in Information Age, and I also podcast with Cybercrime Magazine. So I'm pretty much all over the place.
Wonderful. Well, enjoy your day. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And some more tech news from the week that was, in case you missed it. Amazon's Ring has sparked backlash after its Super Bowl ad promoting an AI-powered search party feature. The commercial showed Ring cameras working together to help find a missing dog and has drawn criticism from privacy advocates and lawmakers who say it normalises AI-driven neighbourhood surveillance and raises civil liberties concerns about how such camera networks could be used beyond pet finding. The search party feature is automatically enabled on Ring cameras, which are also capable of facial recognition technology for humans. Retail giant Bunnings has won a legal ruling allowing the limited use of AI facial recognition technology in its stores as a crime prevention tool. Roblox is on notice with the eSafety Commissioner demanding urgent discussions after reports of children being approached by predators and exposed to harmful content. And that's all for this week. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for all of your reviews and feedback. And if there's something about technology you'd love us to discuss or ask the experts about, send us an email or a voice note. Download this show at abc.net.au is our email. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.